Listen to me.
Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism, broadcasting here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And I am Ethan Clow, your host here on the show. Just a quick update. Last week on the show, I mentioned that we were hoping to have Tom Watson from Forbes joining us to talk about the nonprofit world. Unfortunately, scheduling conflicts got in the way. Hopefully, we can touch base with Tom in the future. But in the meantime, it's just me, Ethan Clow, discussing with you the world of the nonprofit and social justice. And it's been a really busy week, especially here locally in BC, where the big news, of course, is that while the universities and the colleges are back in session and school is schooling across the country, here in BC, teachers are not teaching, students are out enjoying the last warmth of the summer because the teachers are on strike, and they have been on strike for the last couple of months against the BC provincial government. So it's certainly touches on some of our themes here on the show about progressive politics and social justice. So we'll dive into the teacher strike later on in the show with a bit about unions and why they're important and how they've changed the face of the workforce here in Canada. Now, as I mentioned, school is back in session. So the University of British Columbia, where CITR broadcasts out of, is now chock full of eager young minds soaking up information and spending a lot of money on textbooks. So welcome, new students. If you're listening live, The Sector, perhaps this is your first listen to The Sector. And this show, as I mentioned, is all about promoting nonprofits, social justice, and activism, but also sort of diving into these tricky issues, debating, investigating, researching, trying to get a better idea of what is the nature of charity in our country? What does philanthropy really mean? What is it? How does it impact our lives? And does it make us a good person? Or what kind of questions intersect between the realm of doing good and donating money, or doing good and volunteering? And how can we bridge that gap and make sure that the time that we spend giving back is spent the best? Well, and after saying that, I want to launch into a discussion of none other than the pumpkin spice latte. Yes, I know, you might as well have just had a little record go after that big speech. But as you know, it is September. The fall is here, and we all know that what that means is we can now once again enjoy the flavor of pumpkin in our coffee. Or can we? Yes. So, making the rounds on social media these days has been a lot of discussion about what actually goes into your pumpkin spice latte, which you can get from the fine people at Starbucks. And that wasn't an endorsement. I'm actually just hoping they're going to send me coffee now. But anyway, yes, so pumpkin spice lattes, full of chemicals. Did you know that? Icky, dangerous, scary chemicals with long, complicated sounding names, and not a lick of real pumpkin inside them, which means they must be, you know, dangerous and evil and toxic, right? Well, actually, chemicals are not really that dangerous unless, you know, you're talking about like lead paint or something. After all, everything that we consume in food and what we breathe into our lungs, what we put on our skin when we wash up, all of that is made of chemicals. Now, I'm not exactly saying anything new at this point. Everyone who's ever listened to me on my old show, Radio Free Thinker, knows that chemicals can be our friends. And in fact, many chemicals we couldn't live without. H2O, for instance. So whenever you hear somebody talk about the chemical content of something, as in, don't eat that, it doesn't have real food in it, it's just full of chemicals, instantly, alarm bell should go off in your head, and you should instantly say, that sounds like BS to me. Because you know, as well as I do, that everything that we consume is made of chemicals. All the food that we eat, all the drinks that we drink, every coffee that we have, it's all chocked full of chemicals. Because chemicals are the building blocks of everything. They make up the coffee and the foamy stuff and the sugar and the milk we pour in our coffees. They make up every single thing around you right now. You're wearing chemicals if you're wearing clothes. You're doused in chemicals if you have skin. So this notion of being afraid of something or rejecting it because of scary sounding chemical names, don't fall into that trap. So what does go into a pumpkin spice latte, and why is it not real pumpkin? After all, pumpkin is actually really good for you. It's got 141% of your daily vitamin A and about 12% of both your daily potassium and fiber. And you can't get enough of those things. But have you ever actually, like, tried pumpkin? I mean, have you ever picked up a pumpkin and bit into it? It is not the tastiest of snacks, believe me. Pumpkin is also, keep in mind, it is a fleshy thing. It's not exactly like an apple or an orange. Anyone who's ever carved a pumpkin knows what it's like. They're not the most attractive tasting things. And I don't think you would want to scoop out some pumpkin or, I don't know, grind it up in some kind of blender and put it in your coffee. You're probably going to get sort of big chunks of pumpkin floating around, and it's not going to taste very good. So the good people at coffee chains everywhere who make this sort of thing have come up with a pretty ingenious solution. Rather than actually putting real pumpkin in your food, they're going to simulate the taste of pumpkin. And again, instead of actually simulating the real taste of a real pumpkin, which, as I said, is not very tasty, they're going to simulate the taste of something like pumpkin pie, which is very tasty. So what flavors are included in that? Well, I mean, you get your things like nutmeg, cinnamon, ginger, cloves. These are all flavors that, you know, you won't find in your average pumpkin. Which means that if you just took a big chunk of pumpkin, grinded it up, and put it in your coffee, you're not going to get that delightful little taste because it's pumpkin spice. It's all about combining the additional flavors and the additional smell and the additional feel of something like a pumpkin pie. So it's more accurately referred to as pumpkin pie spice lattes, really, if we're being honest with ourselves. So you might say, okay, great. So it's all the flavors and tastes that you get in a pumpkin pie. But why can't it be a natural pumpkin pie? Why does it have to be some kind of chemical or synthetic compound that goes into it to make it pumpkin spice lattes? Why can't it just be, you know, regular, honest-to-goodness pumpkin pie? Well, again, the problem is that it's so popular, and people love to guzzle these things down, and don't get me wrong, I have a few of them myself, but there's simply not enough pumpkin and sauce and spice and sugar that we need to make this sort of thing to meet the demand. So they create, synthetically, they combine chemicals and they replicate the flavoring of the pumpkin pie so that it can be produced and sell lots of coffee. And if you think about it, if you were to actually grind up everything you need to make the kind of pumpkin spice lattes that we want in the volume that we need, you would probably have to convert all of China and India into some kind of massive spice laboratory to get everything that we need and combine it into our drink. And of course, it's going to get cold being sailed across the Pacific Ocean. So that's not really feasible at all, is it? So in the end, the main point here is go out there and enjoy your pumpkin spice latte. After all, it's only here for a couple months and it goes away. Although I think if it stayed around any longer, we'd get sick of it. But enjoy it while it's here. It's a little bit of fun in this, well, dwindling summer, coming fall, and then soon to be here, cold, cold winter. Let's take a quick break here on The Sector, and we'll be back with more after this.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotusland Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are.
Class, shut up! Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
And we're back on The Sector here on CITR with me, Ethan Clow. Continuing on our discussion from the last couple of weeks regarding the CRA and the nature of charity here in Canada, as we've discussed, there have been big concerns about things like an advocacy chill or a crackdown by the CRA, perhaps maybe under the guise of censorship or silencing political dissension, and it is putting a dampener on the ability for charities and nonprofits to do good work in society and help out in the social sector. So far, we haven't found any kind of smoking gun or, you know, memo from the Prime Minister's office to the CRA saying target these charities because they oppose our organization politically. But something that has come up recently, which is, I think, to a certain extent, quite shocking, has been the audit of a left-leaning think tank known as the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. Now, they received under the Access to Information Act a report about why they were audited previously in between 1989 to 1990 and in 2002. Accordingly, CRA, the tax agency, said that they raised questions about the group's political activities, among other non-compliance issues. Quote, a review of the organization's webpage, as well as the previous audit findings, suggests that the organization may be carrying out prohibited partisan political activities and that much of its research slash educational materials may be biased or one-sided. So this touches on a few key points. One, as we've discussed previously, a charity in Canada is forbidden to engage with what we consider partisan political politics. So for instance, if a charity starts to, for lack of better terms, name names or become politically activated in the sense that they are saying, don't vote for Joe Smith, vote for Frank Smith. Don't vote for the political party A, vote for political party B. So, and the more partisan they get, the more in trouble they can find themselves. Now, charities are given a bit of leeway in terms of political activity. So as long as it's not partisan, as long as the activity is essentially neutral, meaning they talk about the importance of a political issue. So for instance, if you have two political parties and the charity's mission or cause intersects a political discussion, debate, factor that's happening in the public sphere, that charity is able to comment on that and say, we believe that this mission needs to go a certain way, that it has to be done a certain way to protect the environment or society or whatever. So that's okay. And they can enter the political sphere in that way as long as they're careful. And as long as they don't devote more than 10% of their resources to that level of advocacy. What qualifies that 10% of resources? Well, that's not exactly clear. And it's also not exactly clear where the leeway is and where general political advocacy begins and ends, and where partisan political activity begins and ends. So you have some, you know, wiggle room there that's not always clear and doesn't really give a charity the benefit of the doubt when it comes to determining what is within bounds of their mission and what is outside of the bounds of their mission. Especially if you have a charity that's primary purpose is to advocate for a given cause or issue that happens to be political. A really good example, of course, is something like an environmental charity. Obviously, their interest, their mission is to preserve the environment. And right now in Canada, that's a very politicized issue. Resource extraction, mining, logging, whatever you want to call it, that's going to naturally bump into the environmental movements in Canada. You cannot be an effective environmental charity without talking about the issues around resource extraction. So you have to be political in that sense. Now, with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, which is a self-defined left-leaning think tank, surely to fulfill their mandate and to satisfy their donors and their stakeholders, they need to advocate and provide research and materials for a progressive worldview. Now, you can compare this to, say, the Fraser Institute, which is a right-leaning think tank that operates here in BC. And the Fraser Institute also engages in, quote, political activity. They provide research documentation, policy alternatives, you name it, procedure that they intend to influence public policy. And they come at it from a politically right point of view. So if the Fraser Institute is engaging in the same kind of political activity as the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, surely they both would be as egregious violations of the political forbiddenness of advocacy and partisan politics. Of course, what's interesting is that the CRA specifically mentioned biased or one-sided research, which is, this is an old, old trick, and something that I think listeners of Radio Free Thinker will also be familiar with. So when you assert that an argument is one-sided or biased or otherwise influenced by the people who are giving you the information, that's fine in many different areas, because you can have an argument where two rational people disagree on a conclusion. With things like science, of course, you don't necessarily have two sides of the issue. You may have debates and you may have arguments over, is this evidence or is this not evidence? But by and large, a scientific question can usually be solved satisfactorily without, you know, hand-wringing of that nature. If I shoot you with a cannon and you die, that's a pretty definitive result that cannons can be deadly. You don't necessarily have half a result. You don't half die. You know, gravity applies or it doesn't. It doesn't half apply or sort of apply depending on where you go. Now, political natures, charities, the sort of social sector, obviously you're going to have disagreement, you're going to have reasonable people coming to opposite sides of the spectrum. But in research, pure research, when you're examining whether or not something works or doesn't work, a bias may be possible, but when you're doing something that's based on science or you're including science in your research, that's supposed to weed out bias. It's supposed to weed out kind of a one-sided argument. Now, again, if the Canadian policy or Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives is focusing on very sort of gray, hard-to-define concepts, that's one thing. But if they're talking about things like harm reduction drug policy, or if we're going to shift gears and talk about an environmental charity, using science in this case is kind of a slam dunk, because you can't necessarily say, look, we've discovered that the resource extraction in this case is very harmful for the environment. Look at all the CO2 it puts in the atmosphere. You can't really have someone come and say, well, that's just your opinion. No, no, we can measure it. Look, it's right there. Look at all that CO2 coming out. It's not necessarily a matter of opinion. It's a matter of fact. So unless the CRA is saying their research is entirely made up, or that it is entirely biased and that they're using kind of really fuzzy language, okay, sure, one thing. But if they're actually doing their research and documenting their sources and approaching it in a very scientific way, that would really rule out a lot of the kind of one-sided problems that you would find with research. Now, the other thing, of course, is that approaching a think tank with the notion of bias also casts light on any think tank everywhere, including things like the Fraser Institute and any other think tank. The general idea, of course, is that they're approaching it from a specific set of research values that would eliminate bias. They're trying to create some consensus with policy and advocacy. If they're just out there flinging out ideas left, right, and center, you know, we think that things should be this way and we think things should be that way. If there's no evidence to back it up, of course it's biased, of course. But then why would they get charity status in the first place? Why would anyone consider their opinion in the first place if it was that willy-nilly, if it was that obvious they're just speaking from a point of view of a bias? So where does this leave us? If we're going to assume that a think tank is biased because it doesn't conform with what we would want their outcomes to be, essentially. If the ruling political party can say, well, we think that we should approach this problem with solution A, and the think tank says, well, we think solution A is wrong, here's our evidence, and we suggest solution B, is that breaking some rule? Is that not fulfilling their charitable mandate as a think tank? Well, I would argue that no, they actually are fulfilling their role. And even if you're, you know, a liberal person, you can look at something like the Fraser Institute and say, well, technically, isn't that what they're doing? You're approaching the solution, or you're approaching a problem with a solution, and the Fraser Institute will say, well, no, we think that the solution is actually this. As long as they're backing it up with research, and as long as they're approaching it in a way that we may not necessarily agree with the conclusion, we may go back and say, argue over their methodology, but I don't think we would argue that they're just being biased or one-sided. We expect them to be one-sided because they're a think tank. They're going to approach things from their point of view, and the way that we approach them is not by shutting them down because they're one-sided. We engage them on their research and say, look, you're making a conclusion based on this research. Well, we don't agree. And then you have a debate, you have an argument, you enter the public discourse. That is the purpose of a think tank, isn't it? Isn't it? Well, while we let that question hang in the air, let's go to another break here on The Sector, and we will return after this.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit endingviolence.org.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we are back here on The Sector. So last week on the show, we talked about the Ice Bucket Challenge. And yes, I know some people are already kind of going, oh, I'm so tired of hearing about this thing. But I actually read a really interesting article on the BBC about this, and I just wanted to kind of discuss it in brief, because I know we've talked a lot about the Ice Bucket Challenge. I mean, not us personally, but, you know, the internet has discussed it at length. One of the interesting criticisms that keeps popping up is that the Ice Bucket Challenge is about narcissism. And narcissism is an interesting concept for the nonprofit world. We like to think of ourselves as humble, giving to charity, not really expecting a reward. We don't want the light shone on us. You know, we want to be kind of like low-key about it. Here's your money. Yeah, I'm a good person, but you don't need to give me a parade. Although, and one of the things that we learn about in the nonprofit sector is that sometimes we need parades, and we need it badly, because one of the reasons that people don't donate is because they're unaware of the need. They're unaware of the impact they can have. What's a way that we can raise awareness about that impact and raise awareness about the importance of giving is to shine a light on those who do give. Essentially, while somebody might be saying, no, I don't want a reward, we need to kind of grab them and drag them into the spotlight and go, hey, everybody, look at this guy, really generous, great guy, helping out, because that can motivate other people to get involved and donate. And that's really important. It may rub us the wrong way, and it may kind of make us go, I don't want the spotlight. But if we can change the way society thinks about donating and making it less of a private matter, something that we think about internally, and make it more external, make it something that is socially expected, that's socially discussed, so that at the dinner table with friends, with family, you're talking about, well, what charity do you support? And I think I should support this charity. And what do you think about that charity? Make it more front and center. Let's not put donating behind this kind of veil of secrecy. Let's bring it out into the open. Let's shine a light on it. Let's have a party when it comes to donating, because it is an important thing to do. The other aspect about this, of course, is that with narcissism, it's not necessarily that a particular charity is capitalizing on narcissism, but also that a particular charity is, unfortunately, forced to rely on narcissism. And there's actually good reason to rely on narcissism. I mean, for a lot of reasons, our society is kind of self-obsessed. You look at music, you look at culture, you look at society, it is heavily focused on me, me, me. So if you're a charity and you want to capitalize on that, if you want to gain traction in today's culture, you have to a certain extent, fit into that. There's some really interesting examples, of course, like Movember, which is the month where in November where men are encouraged to grow mustaches and sort of weird facial hair. to raise awareness for testicular cancer or mental health or, you know, any kind of health-related cause. And it took off, of course. I mean, Movember was a big success. You can look at the No Makeup Selfie, which was a campaign. I think it was more popular in the UK than it was in North America, but it raised $8 million in just 6 days over social media, which, I mean, compared to the Ice Bucket Challenge is chump change, but when that happened, that was like everybody in the nonprofit sector went, what? Because that never happens. The social media component for that left everybody going, well, but what? Huh? How? What social media? That social media? That raised money? That's really weird. And people are still trying to figure it out because that's never happened before. So you could say, okay, well, that's a sign of a narcissistic society that men are being encouraged to give to charity because they get to, you know, grow funny facial hair. Women are taking pictures of themselves and posting it on social media. But I think it's also important to consider that, you know, a mustache and weird, you know, facial hair is not exactly considered attractive. It's not like, you know, considered something where normally men who do that would be getting a lot of attention. They'd be kind of looked at as sort of strange. But for a month, it gives people a chance to experiment with their presentation of themselves, and that took off. Arguably, the same can be said with sort of the No Makeup Selfie. Most women would probably not be keen to showcase themselves without makeup. I mean, there's reasons for that that are sociological, but we're not going to go into it. But nevertheless, it took off and it had a big impact. You know, likewise, having a bucket of ice water dumped on your head doesn't exactly make you super attractive or you would think would make you want to be seen by potentially millions of people. And yet, it seems to be working. And granted, there are a few people who do look kind of attractive when they're soaking wet. But nevertheless, in this case, narcissism seems to be paying off. Let's take a quick break and we'll be back after this here on The Sector.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow. And so I mentioned at the start of the show the ongoing strike here in BC, teachers versus the province. Now, I don't really want to get into the nitty-gritty details of why the strike is happening and what they're asking for and their demands and the, you know, counter-arguments from the province. I think that that argument is happening well enough on its own. Rather, I wanted to talk a bit about unions and why they matter and why they're important in today's day and age. One of the things that always, to a certain extent, surprises me is that whenever there is a well-documented strike, whenever there is a labor stoppage, here in Canada or in America, or really anywhere, any high-profile strike, there's always a very strong backlash against unions. And I always wonder why that is. Why is there such a strong rejection of unions and organized labor across the board? And of course, it's not just rhetoric that gets tossed around about unions or why a union is problematic or why that they are hurting the economy. We also hear about things where striking or picketing workers are being harassed, they're getting screamed at by passing motorists, or somebody throws a Coke can at their head or something like that. You hear about these things and you think to yourself, why is this happening? Why are unions viewed with such contempt by society? I think that there are many different reasons why, and it's hard to nail down. Perhaps it's a view of a rejection that somebody is trying to sort of move up in society, that somebody's trying to get above their station. Perhaps it's simply a view of unions as a instrument of progressive society or progress or whatever, and people feel threatened by it. Or perhaps it's because they see unions as greedy. Perhaps it's because they see unions as taking too much of the pie instead of it, you know, being distributed equally. Perhaps it's because people see unions in a way that it's kind of storming the front. It's using aggressive policies and aggressive strategies to get what they want, which is, you know, raises and more vacation time and blah, blah, blah. It's a whole bunch of things that they don't really need. Well, whatever the reason why, and we're going to explore that in a bit more detail, I wanted to talk about some of the things that unions have done for modern society. So if you've ever found yourself with a weekend, you know, Saturday and Sunday, those days, having days without work is something that unions were able to do for us as a society. Things like having a coffee break or getting a lunch break and not being clocked out for your break so that, you know, you're only working 4 hours instead of 5 hours because you took some lunch. That's something that we can thank a union for. Getting a paid vacation. Getting the chance to go away for a week or two, still make money, still not endanger your livelihood. Again, something that a union was able to get for us. Things like family, medical coverage, sick leave, minimum wage. That's really a good one. The civil rights in the workplace, being able to go into work and not have somebody, you know, pinch your butt or call you names or put you in the corner because, you know, you're a different race or something. Granted, there are still workplace harassment problems that are ongoing, but because of the work of unions, we've been able to push that minority of problems into a category of so inappropriate that almost everybody will agree that that's just not something that we can allow anymore. When you think about it, those type of things used to happen all the time. And again, not that I'm saying those problems have been fixed, I'm not, but it used to be a lot worse. Of course, things like having an 8-hour workday, not being expected to show up at 6 a.m. and stay till 9 p.m. Getting overtime pay when you do go over your regular time. You know, these are all things that we take for granted that back in the day, you know, that wasn't the way things worked. And you just had to be lucky that your boss wasn't a tyrant. Otherwise, you would be stuck with these problems. And in certain circumstances, they had the leeway to say, oh, okay, you're not going to work, you know, 16 hours a day. Well, then you're fired. And unfortunately, in those kind of conditions, there's probably a line of people who will take that job because they're starving to death. And if they can't work, they can't feed their families. So it was a form of oppression before we were able to organize, before we got things like a workers' rights that allowed us to enjoy the kind of lifestyle that we have right now. Now, before we talk about why these things are important, and I'm sure that most of people already know why these things are important, because let's face it, that's pretty obvious. Let's go back to a time in the past. I want you to picture the city of Winnipeg back in 1919. This is right after the First World War came to a close. Soldiers were returning home to discover a radically different society than the one that they left. There were more women in the workplace. There were more immigrants in the workplace. Workers were coming home and finding that their old job was gone. Canada, like every other country, was rapidly industrializing. The workforce was changing dynamically in terms of the work that was being done, how things were being constructed and automated, as well as the faces that you saw at your workplace. Women, minorities, different groups of people were now in charge. It was a whole new world. And with that dramatic change came a new way of looking at things. For the governments of the post-war period, they were very concerned with the rise of communism in Russia, of course, the Russian Revolution just happening. So they viewed that any kind of strike action or unionization that was going on was a threat to national security and had to be responded to in a very harsh way. So when workers were coming home from war, some of them dealing with, let's face it, I mean, life-changing disabilities, they were dealing with post-traumatic stress, they were dealing with people with lost limbs, they weren't able to do the same work they could do before, and many of their jobs were gone, many of their livelihoods were now in shambles. So, naturally, they were going to start demanding things. They were going to demand compensation, they were going to demand increase to wages, job protection, and unions. What happened, of course, was the Great Winnipeg General Strike. Large union organizations created a citywide strike where about 30,000 employees of the city went on strike. At the time, the newspapers and the government created this fever of communism and anti-strike propaganda, which basically caused this whole powder keg to go off. The government called in the RCMP, which assaulted the crowds. They arrested people. They beat people with clubs and rifles. Mass pandemonium erupted, and the entire city was essentially occupied by the military. It came to be known as one of the most violent crackdowns on worker rights in history. And in general, the resulting aftermath of the strike led to a change of Canada's political sphere. New worker regulations came into place. It was a major watershed moment for the country and, of course, for North America as well, because this was one of the biggest strikes in the history of North America. So it's important to remember where we came from when it comes to talk about unions. Now, you might say, well, Ethan, that's all well and good. Workers had it pretty hard back then. But nowadays, you know, everything's great. Everything's been fixed. We don't need unions anymore. And sadly, that seems to be the direction that we're going in society. But, as we all know, progress is not necessarily a permanent thing. It doesn't necessarily just keep going up and stay up. It has to be maintained. Otherwise, it's going to come crashing down. When you look at society today and we see the wealth divide between the haves and the have-nots, we've seen a shrinking middle class. We've seen an increasing poverty line. We've seen the cost of living go up and up and up and up. People here in Vancouver don't need to be told, look at the cost of housing, of rent, of just even, you know, food, groceries, supplies in general. Everything has gone up in terms of cost. And nowadays, you know, the average cost for a family, of course, is going up as well. Things like education, healthcare, general society stuff. All of that has gone up. And have we compensated for this rising cost of living? Have our salaries gone up? Have our benefits gone up? Have we taken more time to sort of enjoy the fruits of labor? I would argue that no, we haven't. That we haven't taken that extra time or given a little bit extra to the workers who have helped maintain this great, wonderful boon to society. When we talk about things like maternity leave, harassment in the workplace, compensating workers properly, you know, these are ongoing problems. They're not getting fixed by themselves. We can't just rely on the business world to fix these problems for us. We have to negotiate and advocate and bring about change that we need. And that, of course, is the role of the union. It is to advocate on a collective behalf. When you look at the growth of Canada's economy over the last 10 years, we've seen some pretty remarkable things. I mean, Canada has done very well for itself as a nation. And yet, you look at the spread of wealth across this country, and it hasn't evened out. We don't see a large middle class. We don't see that wealth being distributed equally. We see it being concentrated in the upper levels of society. At the same time, we've seen the loss of a lot of unionized jobs here across Canada. High-paying, important roles by unionized workers. It's dropped down significantly. Not only has this weakened the middle class, it's weakened them in terms of their buying power, of their economic power. It's weakened them in terms of their future, in terms of pensions, in terms of survival rates. As they get older, as this generation gets a bit older, what are they going to do? How are they going to support themselves in their old age? These are major questions that are going to come back to haunt us if we don't correct these problems as are happening now. And as I've mentioned in previous shows, there's a really important reason why we look after workers as an organization, as a company does at least. It's because they want to retain loyalty. You know, companies lose so much intellectual capital and human resource capital when they have people constantly jumping ship or getting poached or headhunted to a different company or a different firm. So they have to reward that work. They have to make sure that the people are appreciated, that they stay in their job, that they're able to maintain that important intellectual capital that helps make that organization run properly. If you have an organization, a manual labor organization, let's say, that relies on skilled workers to build cars or railway lines or whatever, and suddenly you have employees say, well, you know, screw this, I can get a better job working somewhere else. Well, good for them. They can go get that better job. But the company now is going, well, that's great. We have to train somebody new. That's going to take like 3 years. We have to make sure they're the right qualified and they have the proper credentials. We have to make sure that they're up to speed in all the safety regulations and all the realities that go into running a sort of organization like ours, whether it's heavy-duty construction or whether it is a really important skill-intensive job. So it's in their best interest to keep their talented workers. And as we've mentioned, you know, this type of employee engagement is really important. The nonprofit sector takes it very seriously. That's one of the reasons why corporations often partner with nonprofits so that employees can feel like they're making an impact in their community to make the world a better place. Unions, in their own sort of way, help employees feel connected to their company. If they know that they're going to get high wages, they're going to get protection from the union, they're going to get a good social safety net from their job, they're less likely to jump ship. And that means that the company can count on their intellectual labor, it can count on their base of knowledge, not running away, and so, you know, that's security for them as well. One of the interesting factors, of course, in today's economy is that it's expected that people are going to move around a lot in their jobs, in their job, you know, career. They're going to have multiple different careers, multiple different homes over the years in terms of where they're working, what they're doing. That wasn't always the case. And if you look at it in terms of, you know, what are you going to get out of your career in terms of moving around so much, compared to staying in one place, climbing the ladder, gaining the skills, and becoming super qualified to do your job, I don't know. I mean, it's a trade-off. Is it a good trade-off? So when we criticize unions, when we criticize, you know, the greed and that they're just trying to get above their station and they don't want to work hard and they're trying to get this concession and that concession so they can have more days off, well, wouldn't we be better off with more days off and higher wages that allow us to afford houses and raise our families and get ahead in life? aren't those things good? I mean, don't we want to have a society that values that kind of reward for hard work? And looking at the teachers as a good example, if we're not paying our teachers a fair wage, indeed, if we're not paying them a good wage, not never mind fair, let's talk about a good wage. Let's talk about giving them the resources to do their job in a way that makes them successful, makes them feel connected and satisfied. Well then, I mean, we're going to start losing teachers, aren't we? We're going to have teachers who start their career, maybe work for 5-10 years and go, you know what, I can make more money somewhere else. And they're going to go somewhere else to make more money. So you're going to have this revolving door of teachers in much the same way that you have a revolving door in so many other industries. The day where you will have a teacher and they'll teach you for a couple grades, you'll move on, and then your kids might learn from that teacher, or, you know, all your friends will grow up learning from that teacher. Those days will go away. And we won't have that level of consistency, and we won't have that level of job security anymore. To me, that seems like a bad thing. The idea that someone is going to go through their life, trained to do something, and then do it for a few years, and then switch to something else. I mean, that is costing the economy. It's not just an individual cost. It's not like you can say, well, ha ha, you chose this career, you're stupid, why didn't you pick something stable and, you know, valuable and blah, blah, blah. Well, the joke's actually on everybody because it hurts the economy when people aren't able to pursue their passions. When they have to constantly go back to school, rack up more student debt in order to get the training they need to be successful in the job that they want to do. It's a big problem. Well, we could probably go on more about unions and their role in society and why they're important, but we are running out of time here on The Sector. So let's wrap things up. We'll end on the good note that we have a lot of great things in society because of unions. So let's make sure that we are thinking clearly and rationally when it comes time to reporting on things like the teacher strike here in BC and other important high-profile job action across the country. And we'll keep that in mind and see where the future takes us. Now, if you're enjoying The Sector and you would like to send us your comments, your thoughts, your criticisms, maybe you think unions suck, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. There you can download all of our episodes, our past episodes in podcast form, as well as access our show notes so you can look up our references, always important. And feel free to visit us on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast, as well as follow us on Twitter at sectorpodcast, and feel free to follow me at Ethan Clow. So we both tweet out some pretty interesting nonprofit social justice-y stuff, and I'm sure you will enjoy it. So give us a follow. And of course, remember to tune in next Friday at 8 a.m. for another episode of The Sector. Thanks for listening. See you next week.